Okay, we'll move on to item seven. Consider and take possible action to adopt the December 31st, 2023 valuation report and contribution rates for the period July 1st, 2025 through June 30th, 2026. This is an action item. And we have Paul Angelo et al.
So I'm going to do some logistics plugging in here, but to get us started, I want to first introduce the board to Todd Towser. As the chair mentioned, I am retiring at the end of this month. October 1 will be my retirement day. That's the day I put the R and see Sarah, you know that R stands for. So we're all doing that. So while I plug this in, Todd Towser has been with Siegel for 5 years, very specifically brought into the firm to, as part of our succession management and planning. Andy and the rest of the team will continue to be in service to see Sarah. But Todd, why don't you introduce yourself a little bit and while I plug in here and see if it works.
Just want to make sure I'm not in the way. All right, good morning. My name is Todd Towser, and I'm excited to be here. As Paul mentioned, I've been with Siegel for about 5 years working on plans up and down California with Paul and Andy, so it's been a great pleasure to work with them. I also lead our national public retirement practice, so I help oversee the work that Siegel does for public pension plans across the United States. So I do have that additional perspective of what we're doing in other states and other parts of the U.S. as well. A quick background for me is I started my career at CalPERS. I've always been a public pension actuary here in California. That is definitely my passion. So I spent almost 10 years at CalPERS, kind of grew up there as an actuary. At the end of my career there, I was the senior pension actuary in charge of asset liability management and risk. I've always had a focus on risk for pension plans, and some of you may have heard me speak at SACRAs and other events regarding some of these topics. Because of my focus on risk, I had the opportunity to leave CalPERS and join the public finance world for a little while. I joined Standard & Poor's, S&P Global Ratings. And S&P at the time was basically trying to better understand the trajectory of pension plans over time, public pension plans. So they were trying to understand what decisions in the past had been made that led to where plans were today, and what decisions were being made today and where might that lead to in the future in terms of fund status, in terms of contribution rates, et cetera. So I got to lead those efforts as their director of municipal pensions. I trained about 100 municipal analysts on how to analyze the core mechanics and risks of pension plans, and then we went out and evaluated pension plans across the United States. So that was a very interesting position I did for a few years. And then, as Paul mentioned, I joined Siegel over 5 years ago. So that's my path to being here, and I look forward to working with all of you more in the future with Andy and the rest of the team.
Thank you, Todd. You also give a great talk on the relevance of percent funding. And so maybe one of these days we'll have truncated educational session from you on that.
I would be happy to come and talk about that specific to see Sarah. Yes.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Todd. So we're going to be here to present the actuary evaluation report for December 31, 2023. You just heard a description of the audit of that from Chiron, and we very much enjoyed working with Chiron on the audit. We're going to be presenting from the valuation report. I'll be jumping around a little bit, and also I'm going to be doing most of the presentation here because this is actually not just my last presentation with you folks. This is the last time that I will be client-facing a public retirement section system here in the great state of California. So my team has very graciously allowed me to do the bulk of the presentation here. We'll have Todd come in to talk about this LD-ROM thing that Chiron mentioned as well. So in the Val report, you may be familiar with the general layout here. We start in we start with purpose and highlights here, which is on page six. This just talks about why we do the valuations, pretty basic. But then we really go then on page seven to the valuation highlights. And there's some new formatting here, In the past, we had over on the left margin reference pages, so you could easily tell where you would jump to find more information. Well, we are also, with a lot of California industry, going through accessibility transitions for our documents. And it turns out if you have those little things on the side, those don't work with the sort of machine readers that are sometimes used to increase accessibility for the report. So we still have the references, but they're now embedded in the paragraphs here. We started by talking about the funded ratio. Your funded ratio is relatively flat from 91.2 to 91. That's smooth value. On a market value basis, which is more volatile, went from 84 up to about 87. There's a graphs on pages, a table on page 44 and a graph on page 45 that shows the history of this. What you'll see, if we go to that, I can do that just by going 44 like that. This goes back, even though the table only shows 10 years, I've actually asked the staff to continue to show, let me roll this up a little bit. There we go. To go all the way back to 2007, I like to see the year before the global financial crisis. And you can see here the green squares is the funding ratio on a market value basis, and the red triangle, and also there's a blue diamond underneath it. They're pretty much the same, is on a smooth value basis. You can see, for example, back in 2008, the funded ratio on a market value basis plummeted, whereas the smooth value stayed a little more stable. So this is another way to see what we call the smooth value dance. When the market is up, the funded ratio on a market value basis is higher. When the market is down, it's the other way around. And we had a real back and forth in the last couple of years. In 2021, when you look at investment returns, you had a much higher than assumed return. Whereas in 2022, you actually had a negative return, and that's why you see those numbers doing that crisscross there. But we also see how over time, the two numbers remain relatively close to each other. I'm now going to go back to page 7. Oops. Pick that thing up. There we go. With the unfunded actual accrued liability, as you know, and it was described all in the audit, is the difference between the accrued liability, which is the cost allocated to past years of service, and the valuation or smooth value of assets. That did increase, and as you're familiar, one of the pages that we really like to focus on in this is on page 29 of the report, where we actually show a reconciliation of how we get from last year's unfunded accrued liability to this year's. So on this page, we start at the top where you can see that last year, the unfunded accrued liability was about $1 billion, $1,050,000. If all assumptions had come true, the way that this accrued liability evolves from one year to the next is first you accrue another year of normal cost. The accrued liability is basically the value of all the past normal costs. So during the year, one year of normal cost goes from being in the future to being in the past. So the accrued liability in that case would grow by about $285 million as you accrue another year of cost for your active members. There are also administrative expenses. Then you have contributions come in, and then everything is adjusted with interest at the end of the year. So the thing is, you can think of that $454 million of contributions. First, it goes to cover the normal cost. Then it goes to cover interest on the accrued liability and the normal cost. And whatever's left over goes to reduce the outstanding balance or principal on your unfunded liability. And what you see here is we are in positive amortization territory. That is, if all assumptions had come true, there were no surprises, your unfunded would have gone from $1,050,000 down to $960 million. And at some point, we're going to look at your amortization schedule. That's where you can really see why it is that you have this, your very strong funding policy. Well, there's always stuff that you don't expect. And so then we have the various items that change the unfunded liability from that expected value of 960 to the actual value down at the bottom of $1,115. The first one to note is your investment return. We'll look at these in a second, but as a preview, your market value return for 2023 was actually about 8.7%. But because you had that big loss in the previous year that we're still recognizing, your return on a smooth basis is 5.3%. 5.3 is less than your assumed 6.75. That difference in dollars is about $155 million. So because of your smooth return was less than your assumed return of 6.75, that alone increased your unfunded by about just over $150 million. You did have actual contributions greater than expected. That's partly because we actually had a reduction in contributions from last valuation to this valuation. There's an 18-month lag between when we do the valuation, when the rates actually go into effect. And so the old higher rate actually stays in effect a little bit longer than our computer program thinks it's going to. So that alone is responsible for a reduction in the cost here. You also had an increase in payroll, which means that you collected your payments toward the unfunded on a payroll that's bigger than we thought it was going to be. So that also gets you a little bit extra contribution. So that's all good news, about $53 million. The other thing to notice here, you did have individual salary increases. This is line E, 7E. Individual salary increases were greater than expected. That means that, you know, last year we projected salaries to retirement based on our assumed growth rate, assumption for salary increases. Well, if we now start with a salary this year that's higher than we thought it was going to be, that means the projected salary is going to be higher than it was last year. So we're going to be projecting a higher benefit. So that comes in at about $66 million. Those are really the three big pieces. So you put all those together, we have a total unexpected changes in the unfunded liability of $154 million, and that then is why we go from the expected of 960 up to the actual unfunded of $1,115. And by the way, we do a series of side letters after the valuation. Kyron mentioned one of those that has a projection in it. We do this reconciliation of unfunded liability for each of your cost groups. That means that each of your employers is able to look at this table, not for the plan as a whole, but for their individual costs. And there are variations, you know, safety and general tiers will sometimes behave differently, in particular on things like salary increases. So we do have that information as a side letter. Now, instead of jumping to the front, the other reconciliation page that we like to look at is where we reconcile not the unfunded liability, but the employer contribution rate. That's on page 32. So I'm just going to tab over to page 32. And by the way, as is always the case, if there are any questions on any of this, please be sure to interrupt us as we go along. This is not tightly scripted at all. So now we're going to look at some of the same items, but now we're looking at the average recommended employer contribution. I always like to say that 30.01, there is no member in the plan for whom the contribution rate is 30.01, right? This is a combination of all the different safety tiers and all the different general tiers. But if we take that as sort of an overall indicator of the employer cost, last year it was 30.01. Now, some of these change items are ones we already saw, like the first one, the investment return less than expected. We saw how that increased the unfunded liability. Well, if you take that increase in unfunded liability, amortize it over 18 years under your funding policy, divide it by payroll, you get about 1% of pay. So that alone increased this average employer rate by about 1% of pay. Here are some of the other items. The individual 2D is the salary increases greater than expected. That, again, translates here into an increase in contribution rates. Now, line E is the first one that we haven't seen before, because line E is you took an action to change your amortization policy to synchronize some layers to avoid tail volatility. How many people remember that fun conversation? Okay, we're going to look at the effect of that in the table in a little bit. But that alone, and this is something that you knew when you made the action, you know, it's going to change the current number one way or another. The action that you took was to take a whole bunch of layers that had remaining periods of from, I think, 6 to 13 years. Some were charges, some were credits. You made them all 6 years. Net, net, that actually, for the plan as a whole, on average, decreased the employee rate by about 1.5%. Because this is about the payment toward the unfunded, and not the unfunded itself. That's why we did not see this in that other reconciliation. Similarly, for item F, if you're amortizing the unfunded as a percentage of payroll, and this year's payroll is larger than we expected to be last year, partly because you had those extraordinary pay increases greater than assumed, that reduces the payment on average by about 62 basis points. And then finally, we do see here in line 2H, this is the change in active member demographics on normal cost. I believe that this is, Andy, check me on this. This is the replacement effect of the of having the PEPR members come in. This is just 1 year's worth of the effect of legacy members leaving your workforce and the PEPR members coming in.
And that's right.
Okay. Again, the rest of these are fairly small. So net, notice that while we had an increase in the unfunded liability, an unexpected increase, here we actually have a net decrease. And it's something of a coincidence that the total net change of 1.46, all the other items pretty much cancel out. And the one that really is driving the train here is line E, that decision to synchronize, re-amortize some of your amortization layers. Now, again, those are probably the two most informative pages in the report. I always like to pause and see if anybody wants to, any thoughts or comments on that? Hearing none.
I think, like Paul, you mentioned early on, there's a separate rate packet material to go to each of the employers, so they will be able to see how the rate changes take place on their individual cost group, because as Paul has indicated, on the unfunded liability, there are different impacts on the unfunded liability for each cost group, and likewise, the contribution rates changed a little bit differently among the different cost groups.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. So in addition to that separate packet having a separate reconciliation of the unfunded for each cost group, it has this page also, separate for each cost group. So a lot of information there for your stakeholders. Okay. Just because we had so much fun with that amortization change, I do want to show you how that looks now that it's been done. And that is on page 83 of the report. This is the table of amortization bases. It's a little easier to read this year because we decided to break into two pages and put into a bigger font. And what you'll notice here, I wrote in on mine, this is basically one of our very favorite things in the VAL because it lets you see dollar for dollar where the unfunded liability came from. If on the next page there's a total line, when you add up all of these outstanding balances, that's the third column from the right, you add those up, that equals your total, it's actually three pages, that equals your total unfunded accrued liability. So I love it. Someone comes in and says, well, you got a $1.1 billion unfunded liability. Where did that come from? And the answer is, how much time do you have? Because we can show you here dollar for dollar where every dollar of unfunded came from, like reading the rings on a tree. But the key here is you'll see that the first couple, looking at the years remaining, you got a 3, a 4, and a 5, and then a whole lot of sixes. Okay, starting with that one that's in 2011 and going all the way through to the one from 2018 where there used to be 13 years left, all those were synchronized to a six-year period. But the key is, you can see it right here, some of them are pluses, meaning that they were either assumption changes that increased the liability, like we see here in 2012, or actual losses, like we see here in 2012, but some of them were actually reductions in the unfunded liability. Like we see here, there was a gain in 2013. There was an assumption change in 2013 that actually reduced the liability. And we also had an actual gain in 2014. So you have these charges and credits. If you look at last year's report, the way that this worked was a lot of the charges dropped off first, which made your costs go down. Then the credits dropped up and made it go up. And it actually went negative and then would have gone positive. Well, we're not going to let the employers take money out of the plan by having a negative contribution toward the unfunded. So we synchronized all those. And that's what you can see if you go to starting with the next page. This is, again, just the table continues here. Till finally we get here at the bottom where the most recent thing to happen in 2023, you did get a couple of prepayments from a couple of your employers by San Ramon and IHHS. Those are amortized over 18 years. And then you did also have an actuarial loss net. Remember we showed that the overall unexpected changes in the unfunded liability, that was that reconciliation on page 29, was about $150 million. There's that $154 million. That is amortized over 18 years, and that alone increases your unfunded payment by about $12 million. I want to go, now we have this for every cost group. We get paid by the number around here. So, but if we scroll through to the end, you'll see the familiar table. We use the, graph that is, we use these graphs when we were walking you through the decision to do this synchronizing. This is the outstanding balances. The way this is designed is the zero, everything above the zero line is a charge. So if it's green, it means it was an actuarial loss. If it's blue, it means an assumption change that increased the unfunded liability. The things below the zero line are credits, amortization credits, or in this case, outstanding balance credit layers, generally from actuarial gains, or there's some little tiny assumption changes in there as well. And then the black line is the net of the two. So this just shows that over time, as your employer pays off each of these layers of unfunded liability, the unfunded liability outstanding balance will go down. What's more interesting, now this is now the payments. If you look at last year's, this is the one where because the charge layer is dropping off above the zero line, and the credit layers dropping off below the zero line happened at different times, you actually had a precipitous drop in the net payment, actually to below zero, and then it came back up as the credit layers were fully amortized. Well, if you count 6 years out, remember there are a lot of sixes on that table, count 6 years out, you can see there are positive layers and negative layers, but the net of the two is actually very small. And that's why when you go from year six to year seven, it goes from $78 million to $71 million. All those layers that were combined together, the pluses and minuses netted out to really only about $7 million. And so that was the action that you took to give you this much smoother pattern of payments. And then because you go from those six-year layers, the next layer is a 14-year layer. So that means you're actually going to have 8 years there of real contribution stability because you're not going to have any more layers dropping off until you get all the way out to 2038. Now, we always like to tell folks, things are going to happen between now and then. You're going to have more gains and losses. When that happens, the whole curve may shift up or down, but this pattern of the run out of the existing layers is going to remain very predictable as you see it here. So I just want, because we did take that extraordinary action this year, I wanted the board to have a chance to see this. Any questions on that? Are you guys as excited about this as I am? Almost. I want to now go back and look at some of the investment experience and return and results. This starts a really dense and ugly page on page 22. This is your asset smoothing method. It's 5-year smoothing, but we do it in 6-month buckets because of your interest crediting stuff. But what this shows is that currently you are actually deferring losses, which means the market value way up at the top in line one is $10.1 billion, but there's a $500 million of losses that are not yet recognized in the smooth value, and so we're actually running the valuation as though you had $11.3 billion. We like to show down at the bottom of this page how that $532 million of deferred losses is going to show up over the next 4 or 5 years. What this means is if the market value earns exactly 6.75, you will see a loss line from investment experience on a smooth basis, as it shows here, 164, 132, 232, then it kind of flattens out. So most of that $500 million will show up in the smooth value and therefore in your unfunded liability over the next 3 years. Okay, the last thing we're going to look at here, this is another picture of the what I call the smooth value dance. This is now not the funded ratios, but rather the dollar amount. Very similar picture. When the market is up, the smooth value is below the market value. When the market is down, smooth value is above the market value. I actually prefer to look at this in terms of rates of return. Now, this is a little bit different looking than it was in past years. In past years, the numbers were in a separate table, but now we have them all incorporated here. Once again, I like to keep 2007 there. Remember, these are rates of return. In 2007, you pretty much hit your assumed return. Back then, it was probably, Andy, I think it was probably around 7.5%, maybe 7.75. Then came the market downturn of a minus almost 30%, and you were assuming 7%. So to the actuary, that's a 37% loss, huge loss. But you see the red triangles, that's the smooth value return. It follows it down, but more slowly. And then when the market recovered in 2009 and 10, the smooth value, the red triangles, they start gradually pulling back up. You can see this in the numbers at the bottom of the page, or you can see it in the picture. The last 3 years are also informative. In 2021, your market value return at green square was 9.57%. But then in 2022, your market value return was a minus 11.25%. Your assumed return at the time was 6.75, mm-hmm. or maybe 7 back then. That means that from the actuary standpoint, that's an 18% loss. That's what that green square represents. But again, the smooth return, much more stable. So then again, whether you look at it in dollars or you look at it in terms of rates of return, this is where 5-year smoothing is doing what it's paid to do. End of your time. Anything on this stuff? We're going to talk about the LD rum in a second. Todd drew the short straw, so he gets to talk about the LD rum. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, I think the one thing that we put in is a process refinement. For the first time, we are reflecting an asset transfer. So what happened was, especially among our safety membership groups, we see a lot of some members, a total of about 50 this year, who moved from, for example, CONFIRE, the general cost group, to the CONFIRE safety cost group. So when we transfer the membership, the liabilities move over. So up to this point, we haven't moved any assets over. So you can argue that, well, maybe CONFIRE doesn't worry about this, because to the extent that we don't transfer the assets but transfer the liability, we will see a contribution rate reduction on the CONFIRE general side, a slight contribution rate increase for the CONFIRE safety side. However, that transfer also impact our other safety cost group, including county law enforcement. So, and as you are aware, in cost group 1 and 2, where the county general cost members reside, there are other general employers besides the county. So we think that it's more equitable to transfer some assets whenever the members move from one cost group to the other. And as you're aware, we are a big plan. We have a lot of cost groups and we have a lot of employers. So it's not inconceivable for us to continue to see members who transfer from one group to the other. So they, again, the assets that we're moving over are not very huge, but we think that it would be a good process to implement, starting with this evaluation. And we have implemented that after talking to Christina and her staff.
Yeah, and I've jumped in here in page 173. Now, this is in section 4 of the report where, you know, you're not supposed to try this at home, but this is where we actually do an allocation where we allocate the assets to each of the cost groups. So you can see here, cost groups 1 and 2 are primarily the county and the other smaller employers. There's a net transfer out to other cost groups of about $2 million. That's because people tend to go from general to safety. If we go to the next page, we see cost groups 7 and 9, right, Andy? Those are the safety cost groups. Mm-hmm. Here you see a net transfer in of about $1.8 million. Now, there's a lot of other pieces moving around here, but this shows how when folks go from the general cost group to the safety cost group, you know, they're basically taking their liability with them. And so this way we actually move some of the assets over there to help cover it. And that's a new piece for this year. You will not see this line, too, if you look in past reports. The other thing I have to mention, we have a contest in our department every year between you guys and Orange County. You are the two by far the most complicated plans that we work on. They also have a dozen cost groups. So the question is, who has the longest actuarial evaluation report? And I got to tell you, this year, Orange County edged you out by 8 pages. So, yeah, you have a 178-page report here, and they got 186. So better luck next year. We'll see how it goes. Okay. With that, there is a new thing here. Todd, tell me what page I'm on.
49.
Okay, we're going to go to page 49. I'll give Todd a moment of intro here, because if any of you have been following actuarial politics for a while, there's this market value liability debate that's been going on for 15 years. Well, it finally got resolved to some extent by having a new requirement that all funding valuations publish a number that in some way reflects this sort of market pricing, and I'm going to let Todd walk you through.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Just taking one step back before we dive into it. So in December of 2021, the Actuarial Standards Board, who sets standards of practice by which we abide by as actuaries, they decided to update one of their standards of practice. We call them ASOPs, Actuarial Standards of Practice. So this is ASOP 4, and I actually got to talk about this a year and a half ago at Calipers. And this ASOP 4 is actually very important to what we do as pension actuaries. It talks about how we measure obligations, how we measure liabilities, essentially, and then how we determine contribution rates. So if you think about what actuaries do, those are the two primary things, measuring the liabilities and setting contribution rates. And so they made significant updates to that. The good news is a lot of what was updated did not really affect CSERA at all. For example, they talked about disclosing a reasonable actuarially determined contribution. Well, guess what? We already have a reasonable actuarially determined contribution, so we did not have to make any change there. They talked about disclosing the implications of your funding policy. If there's anything, if we're expected to run out of money in the future, if we're expected to have negative amortization, well, we don't have those things. So it's very easy to take on those parts of the updates of ASOP 4, because we're already doing it and we're already in a very good place here. The one change that we weren't previously doing related to ASOP 4 is this low default risk obligation measure, which we call LDROM, that Paul was giving the introduction to. And so this measure is, the idea behind this measure from the theory side of things is, hey, if we have a string of benefit payments, so we have a string of payments going forward, and there's a market instrument that has a similar string of benefit payments and has a similar amount of risk and stability and all those things, they're very comparable between the two, then they should have a similar discount rate between the two, or a similar earnings rate, or whatever you're looking at. So the idea is, if you can find a market instrument that you can compare your string of benefits to, or a string of payments to, then you should look to that potentially for the discount rate. So that's the theory behind this LDROM number. And for a pension plan, we're looking at streams of benefit payments going forward, and those benefit payments are actually quite stable. We think CSERA is going to continue to be around, the employer is going to continue to fund it, and it's pretty predictable from one year to the next, on at least a large scale across all our members, what we think those benefit payments are going to be. And so because it's quite predictable, the theory that we're talking about here says, oh, we need to go look at a market instrument that's also quite predictable, what you would call a low default risk market instrument. So that's why it's called the low default risk obligation measure. And we're talking about U.S. Treasuries, for an example, or highly rated corporate bonds. You could even look at highly rated municipal bonds, but they've got to be really dependable and stable over time. And so that's the idea for this measure. I should clarify immediately that this is a disclosure item only. We don't have to calculate contribution rates on this. We don't have to calculate funded ratio on this, but we do need to calculate an additional, what you might call additional liability measure based on this LDROM. So that is in your report. It's on page 49. We have it up here on the slide, 49 and 50. If you think about U.S. Treasuries and highly rated bonds, the discount rate for those kinds of things are much lower than 6.75, usually in between about 2 to 4% for a lot of those. For what we used, it was 3.26%. So under half. Is that right? Yeah, under half of what we'd use for our actuarial liability discount rate. So you can imagine what would happen if we lower our discount rate quite a bit. And we've seen going from, what, 7 to 6.75, what that does to the plan. Here we're dividing it by two, basically. And in that sense, you're going to get a much higher calculation of liabilities. And if you were to translate that into funded ratio, it would be a much lower funded ratio and all of that. So again, just this is disclosure measure only, and we tried to put a little bit of meaning attached to this, at least from our perspective. How can you interpret this kind of measure? So if we have our actuarial accrued liability here, and we have the LDROM liability measure way up here, the difference between the two, you can think about it two different ways. At least we like to think about it two different ways. The first is, well, if we were to take our entire investment portfolio and actually sell our equities and sell our alternatives and all of that and just invest the entire portfolio in low default risk market instruments, basically if we were to de-risk the entire portfolio, then we would use such a discount rate, a 3.26 discount rate or something like that. So the difference between the actual accrued liability and the LDROM is basically the cost to the plan, the cost to the employers over time, that it would be to de-risk the portfolio and completely invest in low default risk market instruments. So that's one way you can think about it. But you might say, oh, well, we're not planning to do that. We're not planning to sell all of our portfolio off and invest only in these assets, and it might even be impractical to do so. So the other way you can think about the difference between the actuarial accrued liability and the LDROM is, well, if we continue with our diversified portfolio of assets that take on some risk with our equity and take on some risk with our other market instruments, well, the difference in those two numbers is the amount that we hope to save the taxpayer over time by having such a diversified portfolio and by taking on some measure of risk. We can't ignore that we have a risky portfolio. We have volatility. We have all of that. But we're hoping, by taking on such a diversified portfolio, to earn that over time, that expected return that we use. And so the difference between those two numbers is what we hope to save the taxpayers by not just investing in a low default risk portfolio that's 100% that way. So I didn't even mention the number. It's on page 50. The LDROM for the plan is $20.3 billion. So again, quite a bit higher than what we'd have just with our actual accrued liability. And of course, the actual accrued liability is 12.4. So you can see here how that is almost double the amount And so hopefully that provides a little context of this number. We're going to be providing it every year going forward in the risk section of the report, just a single page dedicated to this as required by the actual standards of practice. But if there are any questions on that, we're happy to answer it. But that concludes my remarks on LD-ROM.
It's somewhat ironic that when all this assessment was going on, the LD-ROM discount rate, instead of being 3.26, was down like 1 or 2%. That would have made that $20.3 billion lot bigger. So just as it happens, in the first year of disclosing the LD-ROM, the numbers are closer together than they historically would have been, just because of 3.26. Although the 3.26 also, yeah, I think that got as high as probably in the fours, and even it's down a little bit.
Yeah, it's coming back.
This was a controversial issue as it came around. What finally, the last thing that changed was a pure market value liability type calculation would not use a level cost method. We use this entry age method. It would use an accrued benefit method. So it would not only have a different discount rate, it would also have a different method of measure because it's basically a settlement measure. But between exposure draft one and exposure draft two of the revision to ASOP 4, the standards board said you can use the same cost method that you use for funding, and all you do is change the discount rate. Well, that's what it allowed for this interpretation. So now we can honestly say it's really what your funding liability would be if you invested this way. So it's either the cost to de-risk, as Todd said very well, or it's the amount we expect to save the taxpayers by having a reasonable level of investment risk in your portfolio. So, but we will be living with this number forever. So, sir. Well, the standards board believes that it provides useful information about the cost of risk. I think that's what it is. Now, if you get me late night in a bar, we can talk about the actuary politics and all kinds of other stuff. But I think that the official reason is that if you're going to be invested in risky assets, this is a way of quantifying in an accrued liability type of measure, what would be the cost to avoid that risk, and what is the expected savings of that risk? So I will stay on script and say that that's really the purpose of the measure.
Thank you. And
if I may add, just one thing, just in terms of perspective, the challenge of using an expected return type measure as a discount rate is we can take on more and more and more risk and hope to get more and more reward, and hope to take a higher discount rate and lower our liabilities and make everything look rosier. And I think the actual standards board was sensitive to that. So not that this board is doing that, but just generally speaking, when you use an expected return discount rate, there is that risk. And so I think the actual standards board is trying to propose this as an additional disclosure, at least to provide some perspective on what kind of risk you're taking on and what the difference is between the two.
And isn't it true that for a corporate pension plan, they have to fund that way too?
Yeah, they fund
right?
Yeah, unlike a public plan. Yeah, corporate pensions. And again, part of the debate is, you know, a publicly traded corporation is defined by its market value, right? The whole purpose of management is to maximize shareholder wealth, which is measured in terms of a market price. So I actually agree with the financial economist that for a publicly traded corporation, for a publicly traded corporation, everything about them should be measured on a market-consistent basis, including their pension plans. But the Contra Costa County doesn't have a common stock. You know, the things that inform valuing public pensions are not market finance or financial economics, but more public finance. And public finance is more focused on sustainability and tax revenues and things, but it's not a market price. So that's one reason why we have generally tried to distance ourselves from this number. And we thought it was a fair compromise to say this is just an illustration, a quantification of the effect of taking on investment risk. And Mr. Chairman, this concludes my prepared remarks. Now, this concludes a whole career of prepared remarks.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to have you work with us and to know you through your work here with Sarah, but also on many of the conferences that I myself have been to. It's been especially with Sackers and calipers and so forth, and your educational value. What I've learned from you has helped make me a better trustee.
Well, thank you.
And so I appreciate your years of service, and I hope to be able to see you around. I know it's like, in your retirement, why would you go to another Sackers conference? Or,
Just sing. Actually, I would have gone. I would go to Monterey because it's nearby, and I like Monterey. But it turned out that week, the symphony I sing in the San Francisco Symphony Chorus, and we will be performing the Foray Requiem. And so, from now on, when there's a conflict between work and singing, guess which one's going to win. So yeah, so yeah. I'll be on stage at Davies while you're down in Monterey.
Okay. All right. Any other questions or comments regarding Siegel's presentation? Okay, then do we have a Candace, please?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Do we have a motion on the agenda item?
I move to accept the actuary report in a second.
Okay, we've had a motion in a second. Now, so Candace is gone, so who's voting? So we're down to eight.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So Jay's going to vote twice. All right. All right. So the vote. So Candace's not here. Chubadarev?
Yes.
Scott's not here. Holcomb's not here. Kroll?
Aye.
McDonald? Aye. Mirzwa?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Wong?
Aye.
And Kwan?
Aye.
So we have seven in the affirmative, no votes, and no abstentions. So this item has passed. Thank you all so much. And Todd and Andrew, we look forward to continuing to work with you.
You too. Thank you.
Okay.